Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deedy, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Sam, a sound scientist, came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
It's November 24th, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine. Well, folks, this month we're going to continue with our trend of sports and humanism. So last month, you might remember, we did a show on Barefoot Revolution, which was the concept of barefoot fitness, barefoot living, barefoot running, things like that, and how it relates to humanism from an evolutionary perspective and also just from a scientific perspective in general. This month, we're going to sort of take you down the other end of the spectrum, and we're going to talk about sports and how they're being sort of infiltrated or influenced by Christian evangelism. So the feature segment of our show is with Tom Krattenmaker, who is author of Onward Christian Athletes, and he did a talk at the AHA's 69th Annual Conference this past June. We're also going to play an interview with him just before his segment. And then we're going to finish the show talking about an ad campaign that the American Humanist Association launched earlier in November called Consider Humanism. So first, we're going to hear a clip of Tom Krattenmaker being interviewed by Margaret Downey. Now, Margaret has been an active member of the humanist and atheist community. She served as the president of the Atheist Alliance International. She's founded the Free Thought Society. She's a secular officiant. She's also a board member for the Freedom from Religion Foundation, the Atheist Alliance International, and Scouting for All. Margaret also played an integral part in bringing Tom to the AHA 69th Annual Conference this past summer to speak. So here's a little clip from their interview.
So this is Margaret Downey, the founder and president of the Free Thought Society, and I'm so proud to have in my presence Tom Krattenmaker. And Tom is a well-known author of a new book, Onward Christian Athletes. And I'd like to ask Tom what his particular passion was to have written this book and why it's so important for you to talk about the overtly Christian athletes in America.
I think that what got me going on this topic was watching a lot of sports at the same time that I was beginning to study religion in this master's program that I was in at the University of Pennsylvania. I was really focusing on the history of evangelicalism in America, evangelical activities in the public square and in public life. And I was noticing all this overtly Christian expression in big-time sports. You know, athletes pointing up to God, talking about their faith in post-game interviews, saying God gave them the win. And I started putting two and two together, and I really wondered what was really going on and what was at stake with all this conspicuous religiosity in sports. And I found that there really hadn't been any really thorough journalistic analysis of this, try to put it together, figure out what it meant, and maybe articulate a case about it. So that was my mission with the book.
And what do you hope that readers will walk away from reading your book? What will they take to the ballpark, to the football games? What do you think the new attitude should be towards sports?
I just want people to see this phenomenon for what it is. I would hope that people would begin to engage in some critical thinking about what's going on where sports and evangelical Christianity intersect. I haven't seen a lot of that. I mean, a lot of us who are not evangelicals might resent all this religious expression in sports and roll our eyes or say snarky things. But I think we need more than that. I think we need to develop a case. And I think we need to see this tension that exists between this exclusive and often divisive form of Christianity that is promoted and expressed in sports on one hand, and on the other hand, the very real fact that we have diverse communities supporting these teams, that the public supports these teams through tax dollars in various ways and through buying tickets, and that these teams really do have a public role and public responsibility. So why is this public resource known as our team being turned into a vehicle for the promotion of this particular form of religion.
Well, in some ways, this overtly religious expression is sort of a reflection of what's going on in society today. So, you know, if we can work towards diversifying the athletes to appreciate that there are non-believers as fans, as well as believers, and different religions out there, that maybe we will be taking a tiny step forward with diversity appreciation. But you also mentioned that a lot of the Christian influence comes from situations that people aren't even aware of. And of course, your book goes into that. But could you tell us a little bit more about how Christianity is influenced by certain schools, certain preachers, how that happens to directly influence the athlete?
Well, when I talk with people about this phenomenon, I find that they're often surprised when I inform them that every team in Major League Baseball and pro basketball and football has a Christian chaplain embedded with it. So I think this gets at the idea that this faith activity in sports is very organized, probably more organized than most of us realize. I do try to be nuanced in my take on this. You know, I think there is a role for this. I can understand, given the unique pressures that they face and the logistics, why athletes would want to have some religious resources available to them. So I wouldn't regulate that out of the game. But my hope would be that it's more inclusive. I think it's okay that there's faith in the game. In fact, there are some good sides to that. But why is it so strongly skewed in the direction of conservative evangelical expression? And why is there such a promotion of exclusive conservative doctrine, you know, about who's going to go to heaven or hell and how you have to be washed in the blood of Jesus and these kinds of things? So my hope is that faith in the game becomes more inclusive and more constructive, less about evangelism and more about serving athletes and the communities that support teams.
Well, we have something called the Harvard Chaplaincy. Have you heard of the Harvard Chaplaincy?
A little bit, yes.
And it's American Humanist Association related. Do you see a future that might include a chaplaincy from humanism involved with sports?
It seems a long way off, but I think it would be really positive. That's what I'm getting at when I talk about hoping that faith in the game is more inclusive. Here's another example. In my research, I met a young Jewish man who loved sports. He wanted to be a sports chaplain. Well, right now, he has no chance in hell of getting that opportunity because all the chaplains are evangelical Christians, and the organizations that put them in that position are very few, and they've built these relationships with management. And so the opportunities don't exist if you're Jewish or if you're a humanist or if you're a Muslim or if you're maybe a theologically liberal Christian. So I want people to start asking these questions about that. Why is that the case, and how should it be? What could it be?
Well, I want to thank you very much for that wonderful interview and for writing this great book and for delivering such a terrific speech today. Your PowerPoint presentation was fantastic, and I would highly recommend that other humanist groups around the country host you as a presenter. So can you tell us how to get a hold of you?
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for everything you've done to promote my writing. You were helpful back when I was just starting to write these articles about religion and public life, when I was a complete unknown, and I got my first speaking invitation from you, so I really appreciate that and remember that. Well, it's really easy to contact me. I would love to speak to humanist groups. Just go to tomkrottenmaker.com, and you will find my contact information there. That's tomkrottenmaker.com. Krottenmaker is K-R-A-T-T, as in Tom, E-N-M-A-K-E-R. Thanks.
Well, three cheers to you. Thank you.
That was Margaret Downey interviewing Tom Krottenmaker. Up next, you're going to learn even more about Krottenmaker and his book, Onward Christian Athletes, Turning Ballparks into Pulpits and Players into Preachers. So Tom Krottenmaker is a Portland-based writer, and he specializes in religion in the public life. Tom writes regularly for the USA Today's On Religion commentary page as a member of the paper's editorial board of contributors. The following clip is of Tom Krottenmaker presenting his book, Onward Christian Athletes, at AHA's 69th annual conference held this past June.
Thank you. You know, I really appreciate all of you being here. And it's good that this conference is looking at sports, because it's an important part of our culture.
that too often gets left out of the analysis. Now, as you picked up from the intro in the program, I write about religion and public life, mainly for USA Today. As a writer and a citizen, I'm keenly interested in the way that religion plays out in our public square and culture. Big time sports is one area where religion manifests in conspicuous and fascinating ways, in ways that evoke larger truths and trends. Yet this aspect of religion in public life has not received the attention and the critical examination that I believe it deserves. So my book represents my attempt to begin filling that gap. So in the book and in my talk today, I try to capture how faith shows up in sports and the interesting issues and problems that are raised by that. The reason that this issue of Christianity in sports fascinates me is that in many ways it's a microcosm of the larger issues around the place of religion in our society, brings up many of the big questions and conflicts over the role of religion in public life, including how we accommodate what you might call one truth exclusive Christianity in our diverse pluralistic society, while ensuring a respected place for other forms of religion and for the many Americans who are not religious. So we're gonna look mainly at pro sports, the NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball. A few examples from the college ranks, just to preempt a question. We don't get heavily into women's sports. And I made that decision when I began shaping the book out of the need for a manageable size and scope, and because the issues that interest me are most poignant around those big three men's sports. But you'll find many of these ideas play out just the same in women's sports. Now let me introduce the basic ideas that have come out of my study of Christianity in sports. So the religious expression that we see reflects an intentional effort by evangelical ministries and athletes to use sports as a platform to promote Christianity. So it's not just an accident that we see so much religion on display on stage in big time sports. Now, some of you are probably familiar with groups like the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Athletes in Action. Are these names familiar to some of you anyway? Well, these ministries and others like them have been hard at work for over half a century to leverage the popularity and influence of sports to reach the broad public with their evangelistic message. Now, a big part of the agenda of these ministries and of this Christian movement in sports is to provide athletes with religious counseling and support. In some ways, that makes sense to me because, after all, sports is a sector that could use some positive moral influence. There's a more debatable side to it as well. In many cases, Christianity in sports has aligned strongly with Christian right political ideology, organizations, and people. And I think that most of us would agree, and even many Christians would agree, that the Christian right has been, in many ways, corrosive, has had a corrosive impact on American life. So it's a concern that it's such a big part of sports world Christianity. In addition to that, you'll find that the ministry organizations that dominate the activity in sports teach a conservative and exclusive Christian theology that emphasizes belief in Jesus Christ as the one and only correct take on life, and that emphasizes the imperative to evangelize that worldview. I believe this can work at cross purposes with the interests of the non-evangelical majority of us, and with the cross purposes with the unifying civic role that we expect of our sports teams. The third point, as you see, I think there's been a lack of critical thinking about what's going on here, not just on the part of the promoters and defenders of sports world Christianity, but by many of us non-evangelical and non-believing fans who maybe criticize the religion we see in sports, but without clearly articulating an argument against the current state of affairs. So what legitimate concerns can non-evangelicals articulate about the current shape and form of faith in the game? In other words, what case can we make? And finally, if we have time, we'll look at changes that I see emerging on the landscape that may point the way toward a more unifying and perhaps constructive form of religion in sports. What would it mean if sports ministry didn't devote itself just to evangelism, but rather to mounting a prophetic or constructive public witness against the sins, if you will, of big-time sports in America, the abuses and the excesses, which is what I'm getting at with that title. the salvation of sports. Now, let's watch some television. I want to show you a scene from January 2009 that I use in the very opening of my book. We're going to see Kurt Warner of the Arizona Cardinals doing a quick interview on live TV after his team has just won the National Football Conference championship game.
Post-game show.
Kurt Warner! Well, you're not going to like this, but you're the third oldest quarterback to ever play in the Super Bowl. How's that make you feel?
You know, everybody's going to be tired of hearing this, but I never get tired of saying it. There's one reason that I'm standing up on this stage today. That's because of my Lord up above. I got to say thanks to Jesus. You knew I was going to do it, but I got to do it. And secondly, I just say thanks to all of you guys. When nobody else believed in us, when nobody else believed in me, you guys did, and we're going to the Super Bowl!
So here's how my book opens, riffing on this scene. You knew I was going to do it, the jubilant quarterback said with a shrug and a quick look at his TV interviewer, but I got to do it. And yes, he was right. Whatever we thought of the good or the bad of the deed that Kurt Warner had to perform, none of us who knew anything about the freshly crowned football champion could claim surprise. Like the Fox television host, like many of the 70,000 fans inside that stadium, like many of the tens of millions of us watching on television, lots of us did know that the Super Bowl-bound quarterback was going to use his moment on the victory platform in the live TV spotlight to champion the cause dearest to his heart. From the moment he threw the game-winning touchdown pass to complete his reascension to the top of the pro football world, we in fandom knew with eye-rolling dread, some of us, or with proud anticipation, that Warner was going to proclaim his devotion to Jesus. We knew because Warner, like so many of his pro athlete brothers today, can't seem to let his moments of high profile good fortune go by without bringing his Christian religion into it and without making sure that God becomes part of it for us spectators too. The concept of using sports to advertise services and products goes a long way toward explaining Warner's seemingly forced thanks to Jesus pitch in the post-game interview and a multitude of similar Christian displays furnished game after game, year after year, by the contestants in America's big time sports for advertising Jesus and the religion that revolves around him well describes the nature of Warner's gambit in his moment of championship glory. Unpack Warner's Jesus proclamation, and one begins to understand the dynamics of a Christianity and sports movement that, for all its highly visible manifestations, has a little seen and less well understood history, logic, infrastructure, subplot, and set of implications. More than most athletes, Kurt Warner tipped his hand, revealing the not exactly spontaneous nature of players' shout-outs to the Lord. I gotta do it, Warner admitted. Such is the religious duty that pro-athlete Christians are taught to accept and fulfill by a network of evangelical chaplains and ministry organizations that have long appreciated the advertising value of big-time sports and have long worked to harness the industry's influence to push out their salvation message and draw new people into the flock. Warner telegraphed something else that's important to know about evangelical Christianity and big-time sports, the ever-present pushback. Everybody is going to be tired of hearing this, Warner admitted before thanking Jesus, as if to give all the non-religious spectators the chance to brace themselves or hit the mute button. And Warner is certainly right. Many people do grow weary of hearing multimillionaire athletes proclaiming their Christian faith in ways and in moments that can trivialize religion's complexity as powerfully as they offend and divide portions of the viewing audience. So yes, we did know that Kurt Warner was going to turn his victorious moment into a plug for his evangelical faith, because we're accustomed to hearing victorious players wax religious in a day and age when sports are not only hugely popular, but often drenched with Christian religion. So, end of that passage. So clearly Warner's expression of faith in the post-game coverage is one very prominent example of evangelical belief rising to the surface in pro sports. We see it in other ways too, as you are no doubt aware, if you follow sports. you'll often see players pointing up to the sky as a gesture to God in a big moment of triumph and gratitude. Let's watch a few more TV clips to see other ways in which players invoke their belief in post-game situations. Here's one from the pro basketball world. We're going to watch Dwight Howard of the Orlando Magic being interviewed after his team has defeated the Boston Celtics in Game 7 of their playoff series last spring.
And in the history of the franchise, this is the second time the Magic have won a Game 7. Let's go to David and Dwight Howard.
Told me you dreamed that you guys were going to win this game. Now, you didn't hit the three to win it, but you'll take this, I suspect.
First, I want to thank God, man, because without him, none of this would be possible. I told my guys before the game, we come out, we play 100% playoff, 48 minutes, and God's going to do the rest. And he did tonight. We got a good victory, man. It's all because of him.
Now let's go to the 2008 World Series. I bet Margaret is happy about this still. We're going to see Phillies closer Brad Lidge, who has just nailed down the final out of Philadelphia's series-clinching victory.
In the middle of all that mayhem, down in the middle of the field, is Ken Rosenthal with Brad Lidge. Ken.
Thank you, Joe. Brad, you enter the game 3 outs away. How tough was it to control your emotions at that time? It's honestly very hard to control emotions right now. I mean, this is so incredible. I'm so happy to be here. Thank God, Jesus Christ, my family, and these fans are amazing.
Now let's rewind a few years to a scene from the NBA Finals. We're going to see Chauncey Billups, then of the Detroit Pistons, collect his series most valuable player trophy and make a few remarks. Here's an inside look at what often happens in locker rooms following games. I think this would put to shame many of the more subtle forms of workplace evangelism and maybe forced religion. The degree to which this happens in locker rooms is pretty overt. And this will surprise you because it's Phil Jackson and the LA Lakers who have Jackson has a reputation for being sort of a maverick, used to be a hippie, new age, blah, blah, blah. But as you'll see, they do an explicit Christian prayer after games.
This is a ritual that Phil's had since his days in Chicago. On Sundays, we always get together and say the Lord's Prayer at the end of ball games. You have to give your thanks. And we're all blessed to be in this position and do what we do. And you have to give thanks to the Lord above.
That delivers from evil, from the light of his kingdom, power, glory, forever.
Were there any players on the team that didn't participate?
My understanding is that there are always lots of non-Christian players on a team, but they pretty much go along with it because team unity is a very big thing in sports, especially if you're a marginal player. Nobody wants to be out of step with the mainstream of the team and the coach. And so I didn't see this scene, I just have the TV clip, but I would be of the opinion that everybody participated, even though some of them didn't believe it. But they just kind of want to go along, and it seems like a nice thing.
Well, it's a game.
Yep. We can talk about that more in the Q&A. So, last clip here. This is a fascinating moment coming out of the 2007 Super Bowl. This was a really big moment for me, and I build a chapter around this episode. So, Tony Dungy of the Colts has just become the first black coach ever to win the Super Bowl. And here's what he had to say on that occasion. There are layers of race and religion and politics all wrapped up in the story about Dungy and that Super Bowl and what he did afterwards. You're going to hear a reference to a Lovie Smith, just so you know, that's the coach of the other team, the Bears, also African-American.
Tony, how about this performance by your team tonight? I'm so proud of our guys. You know, we took the hit early with Devin Hester, but we talked about it. We said there's going to be a storm. We said the Lord doesn't always bring you directly through. Sometimes you got to work for it. And our guys just hung tough and played so hard. And I just can't tell you how proud I am of our group, our organization, and our city right now.
This is one of those moments, Tony, where there's also social significance in this victory. And to have your hands on the Vince Lombardi Trophy, tell me what this means to you right now.
I tell you what, I'm proud to be representing African-American coaches, to be the first African-American to win this. It means an awful lot to our country. But again, more than anything, I said it before, Lovey Smith and I, not only the first two African-Americans, but Christian coaches, showing that you can win, doing it the Lord's way. We're more proud of that.
I said it was going to be the last clip, but I recently added another one into the lineup that I want to show you. This is going to be something that played out in the college football world back in December. I'm going to show you the end of the game drama as Alabama completes its victory over Tebow and Florida for the conference championship. And you're going to hear this new top dog, Mark Ingram, talk about his faith.
Another 6 yards, and they're going to go 500 yards on offense. Yeah.
They're going to shut it down, though.
Do they take a knee? Yes, they are. That's classy. How about the loss for Tim Tebow?
That's got to be fun, doesn't it?
Tim, I know this is not how you envisioned your senior season ending. How disappointing is this for you?
It's tough. It's just, you know, it's not how you want to go out, but, you know, I just want to congratulate Alabama, Coach Saban, their players.
Title, and they'll have a chance to go for their 13th national championship. Tracy's with Mark Ingram.
That's right, a dominant performance tonight, 113 yards rushing, 76-yard passing, 3 touchdowns. What was the key for you tonight?
First of all, I just want to thank God. I'm so blessed. And sometimes you got to let go and let God work for you. That's what I did tonight. I just got to give him all praise, all glory. And, you know, we came out here as a team and we fought. We played with a lot of heart, a lot of passion.
So as the guy who analyzes this stuff, I see so much going on in that scene, and I'm sure you did too. So first we saw Ingram mocking Florida by doing their gator chomp. And then we saw Tim Tebow, who was tearfully, you know, relinquishing the championship. By the way, I do give props to Tebow for his gracious comments, commending the other team. I like that in sports. I think that's classy. But you will note that he did not mention his faith. And that is the trend. You'll find that evangelical athletes typically talk about God when they've won, and rarely, if ever, in a moment of losing. So that's interesting. By the way, he had the John 16:33 reference. Who knows what that says? Nope, it's, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I've overcome the world. At that time, Tebow was getting a lot of blowback and controversy, so he might have been referring to that. And then finally, you see Mark Ingram again, the new champion, talking about how God has blessed him with the victory. So just a quick reflection on these clips. At some of the talks that I've done with a lot of Christians in the audience, I've seen a lot of big-time defensiveness. Some people think I'm trying to be snarky or make fun of these guys, and they'll say, Tom, you know, why are you trying to poke fun? Isn't this a lot better than guys shooting guns or abusing women? Well, and I would say, of course. I mean, there's no comparison. And truth is, I don't mean to be snarky about these. Some of these forms of religious expression in sports seem to me relatively harmless and natural. Others seem gratuitous and trivial and divisive. You'd have to ask me about an individual clip and see what I think. But one thing that has become clear to me is that for many Christian sports fans, it means a lot to hear these stars speak up about their faith in these moments. And they appreciate the Christian athletes and coaches for doing this. They're proud to see their Christian belief represented in these high-profile, high-prestige moments. Now, many other fans have just the opposite reaction. What is clear from the clips is that because of the eagerness of sports world Christians to openly express their faith, God is often part of the dramatic moment when games and championships are won, big moments in our culture. For most of the sports audience, this is the piece of religion in sports that we see, right? But it is just the tip of the iceberg. So what I would like to do now is look beneath the surface of the water a little and consider the ideas and motivations of these Christian athletes. Here's what one guy said about it, former Major League Baseball player. The entire reason I play baseball is so that I get a chance to speak about Christ. So clearly that's hyperbolic, but you'll find that this does typify the philosophy of many evangelical athletes and of the ministry organizations that work with them. Now, the same basic idea was expressed in very bold and specific ways by then Indiana University basketball coach Mike Davis 7 or 8 years ago. This was after the Hoosiers made a surprising run in the NCAA tournament, including an upset win over mighty Duke. Here's what Davis said. As a Christian, you know he's working all the time. That platform was set for me because I gave God the credit. I told the people we were going to advance to the championship, and we did. That was God's voice saying, give me the credit and I'll bring you through it. There was no way on paper that Indiana should have beat Duke to play for the national championship, but I knew we would be there. I knew God put me on the platform to share his word. So you hear this again and again when you talk to these athletes, read their interviews in the Christian sports magazines. It's the idea of platform and God putting them in a position of success so that they can promote Christianity. For a little more insight on the strategy of the ministry organizations like the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, consider this statement from an FCA staffer who I interviewed. The Mike Sweeney being referenced, I played for Kansas City back in those days, now he's with Seattle. So this guy from FCA says, I could walk into a restaurant somewhere in Kansas City and announce, folks, I want to share my faith in Jesus Christ. Maybe two or three would turn their heads, maybe a couple would throw a tomato. But if Mike Sweeney were to walk into a restaurant and do the same, every head would turn. 90% of the people would know who he is. Mike could share his relationship with Christ and have an impact. Some people will listen just because he's able to hit a fastball 400 feet. That's the concept of influence. Rather than bemoaning the fact, let's accept that Mike has something to share and equip him to share it. So as this would suggest, there's often a faith coach of sorts behind the Christian player who you see expressing his religious beliefs on TV. Now, I don't mean to suggest that these shout outs and the sky pointing gestures are always scripted or insincere, but I don't think people realize how organized the faith activity in sports really is. When I talk with people about my research, for example, they are often surprised to learn that every team in the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball has a Christian chaplain embedded with it, with sort of this privileged, exclusive access to the team. Part of the reason they're there is to provide religious support and counseling. The idea is that it's difficult for a pro athlete to make it to church on Sundays, for example. Given the unique pressures of their career, I can understand why athletes would want to access some religious resources. But there's another less understood and more controversial part of the job description of these chaplains. Most of them come from evangelical ministries and perspectives. They are there to promote the evangelical message, promoted to and through the athletes who command so much attention in our sports-obsessed culture. Now, when I point this out, some people say to me, well, Tom, you know, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with athletics being used for something positive like the gospel? And what's wrong with ministry representatives or any American practicing and expressing their faith? Well, the fact is, whether I like it or not, religious freedom is something that we have in America. It's a reality. But that's not the whole story. And I believe we should see this phenomenon for what it is. As I often say, this isn't some non-controversial generic form of, quote, faith that's being practiced and promoted in major league sports. I have found that it's usually a conservative and exclusive form of Christianity with a strong emphasis on salvation through Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone, and a strong emphasis on evangelism, converting others to the faith. For an example of the teachings that are typically emphasized in sports world Christianity, let's take a look at the doctrinal statement published by Baseball Chapel, which provides chaplains for all the teams in Major League and Minor League Baseball, based near Philadelphia, Baseball Chapel. So you see what it says. Sinful people may be reconciled to God only through the shed blood of Jesus Christ. We believe in the resurrection of the dead for the unbeliever, resurrection to judgment, and everlasting punishment separated from God. End quote. When I pointed this out in a USA Today column back in October when my book was coming out, I got so much flack about calling these guys out on this stuff. A lot of conservative Christians were saying, hey, if you don't like it, that's tough, man. It's in the Bible. That's what it's all about. That's our duty. We're just trying to save people so they don't go to hell. So this is the belief that's part of Orthodox Christianity. It's shared by many, many Christians, so it's not shocking. My point here is that we should be aware of the belief foundation that underlies the strategy of evangelical ministry in sports. Belief can and does lead to action. And there are numerous stories that I've encountered in my research of overzealous evangelism to Jews and other non-Christians in professional baseball, for example, of non-Christian players feeling pressured to go along with prayers explicitly in the name of Jesus. Maybe of players being taught that Jews are not in good standing with God. This kind of thing flared up publicly in a big way. In Washington a few seasons ago, after the Washington Post quoted a Nationals player describing a certain interaction that he had had with the team's chaplain. Here's how it was reported in the Post. The key part here is the quote from the ball player, the appropriately named Ryan Church. Jewish people, they don't believe in Jesus. Does that mean they're doomed? John, the chaplain, nodded like, yeah, that's what it meant. I was like, man, if they only knew. Other religions don't know any better. It's up to us to spread the word. So I'm sure it won't surprise you to learn that this was very upsetting to many Jewish fans in the DC area. And some leaders in that community pressured the Nationals organization and Major League Baseball for an apology and an explanation. And Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, who was Jewish, by the way, promised that he was going to look into this arrangement by which Baseball Chapel gets to place its people with all of the pro baseball teams. But after promising this review, Selig and Major League Baseball never said another word about it publicly. And my repeated requests for follow-up information over several years were ignored. So we don't know what, if anything, came out of this review. Probably nothing. MLB then acted as though they had never said they were going to look into this arrangement. Well, you can guess why. It's a very delicate subject. And you'll find that sports management typically maintains a silence on these issues because there's potential for pissing off either side of the argument. So let me pontificate here a little bit, which is what I'm used to doing since I write opinion columns for USA Today. Now, I believe this use of sports as a venue for the promotion of a particular form of Christianity is troubling. I say this as one who has a passion for interreligious understanding and cooperation and for protecting the rights of non-believers. And as one who sees how the emphasis on exclusive religious doctrine, you know, the I'm right, you're damned kind of thing, really gets in the way of creating peace and reconciliation between people and religions. Be that as it may, some people say to me, well, so what? You know, pro sports are a private business. If Tom doesn't like it, if portions of the public don't like it, well, too bad, don't watch, don't go to the game. Well, one of my objectives with the book was to try to articulate a case, sort of a common good case, for why the public does have a stake in this. Simply grousing about religion in the game, maybe saying snarky things about athletes, that probably doesn't get us very far, right? But if we think about it, I believe we can make the case that the broad public interest is not well served by sports world religion in its current shape and form, and that the public does have a right to weigh in on this. Pro sports franchises, despite being private businesses, do have a public role and public mission, and with that, a public responsibility. So why do I believe this? Well, there's the unifying role that we expect our teams to play. They create the space where people set aside their differences and cheer together for the home team in the stadium or the sports bar or somebody's house. There's the fact that team owners have invited us to think of the franchises as our team. And we see this in the way that the teams are marketed, in the way that franchises build new stadiums that are financed in whole or in large part by the public. And let's not forget this other crucial benefit given by us, the public, to pro leagues, that is the antitrust exemptions that enable them to function in their current lucrative form. So these are some of the reasons why I believe pro sports franchises have a public responsibility, and why it's cause for concern that our leagues and teams are being used to promote a relatively narrow and exclusive set of religious teachings that can marginalize non-evangelical people in belief that are not in sync with the diverse communities that support teams. Indeed, not even in sync with the mainstream of American Christians, two-thirds of whom believe theirs is not the only path, and who have much more expansive conceptions of salvation. Keep in mind that America is one of the most religiously diverse countries in the world, and that we are becoming ever more diverse. So that's why I see this tension between the reality and the good reality in America on one hand, and what's happening with sports world religion on the other hand. Definitely a tension. So that is my opinion on that. But despite this critique that I have, I want to make it clear that I'm not a religion hater. You may have seen things I've written in USA Today that could be challenging for a humanist and an atheist audience. I do believe there is a place for Christianity in sports and potential for it if it were to focus on more constructive and unifying things. If you read my book, the closing chapter describes sort of a surprising journey I had when I engaged with people at Athletes in Action. And I found that a lot of them were disgusted by what's going on too. And they were keenly aware of the way the culture is changing. The new president of AIA talked to me about how he is very troubled by the way athletes witness. And he's troubled by many of the things going on in sports. And it bothers him that Christian ministry in pro sports has done so little to address some of the big moral problems in sports. That's what I'm getting at with the title of this talk, you know, the salvation of sports. What would it mean if sports ministry wasn't about evangelizing for the certain divisive doctrine, but if it were trying to be a moral and prophetic force to try to save sports from the big, ugly mess that it can be and that it has become? An obvious example for me would be the racism that exists in sports and other forms of exploitation. One very prominent example would be the paucity of black coaches in college football. When I was finishing up my manuscript, there were 6 black coaches in college football at 120 schools that comprise the major division. I mean, what is up with that? And why do the Christians have so little to say about those kinds of things that are going on in sports? And you could go on with lots of other things about sports being out of perspective, about the way the public is squandering huge amounts of money on stadiums and things, while other really fundamental public resources like schools and libraries and roads are being neglected. So maybe it's naive. Some of these change agents believe this too, and they want to see sports ministry evolve. I'm not sure how far they will get. I wish them well. I don't share their doctrine, but I think they do have some good ideas. When people see the title of my book, Onward Christian Athletes, I think most people get that it's mainly ironic. I would say about 91.3% ironic. But there's a little bit of encouragement there too, because I want these guys to bring something better. There's a potential there. I wonder what you think about that, you know, if not just in sports, but if Christianity in our public life in America was more about doing good stuff and serving people, doing unifying things, being idealistic, would we still resent their incursions the same way? It's a fascinating thing to talk about. I don't have anything against Christians, but I don't like the pushing of these brittle doctrinal propositions about who's going to heaven and hell. And the good news is that that is not flying with the public. Even the young Christians don't really have time for all this stuff, and they have a much different set of priorities. So anyway, that is the end of my rant. I appreciate your attention. I'd love to hear what you have to say.
That was Tom Krattenmaker addressing the audience of AHA's 69th annual conference. If you'd like to learn more about Tom, if you'd like to schedule him to speak for your organization, or if you'd like to purchase his book, Onward Christian Athletes, visit his website, tomkrattenmaker.com. That's TOMKRATTENMAKER.com. You can also find that link on the show notes for this episode at humanistpodcast.org. So we're going to end our show this month talking about an ad campaign that the American Humanist Association launched earlier in November. It's called Consider Humanism, and it features ads in major national and regional newspapers and magazines demonstrating that secular humanist values are consistent with mainstream America and that fundamentalist religion has no right to claim the moral high ground. I had the opportunity to catch up with my coworker, Sarah Amy, and she's going to tell us a little bit more about this campaign and what kind of success it's had in the media. Okay, listeners, we're here with Sarah Amy, who is a communications and policy assistant for the American Humanist Association. Sarah, thanks so much for being here with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So earlier this month, the AHA launched an ad campaign. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, the campaign is called Consider Humanism. It's essentially a handful of ads that compare quotes from the Bible and the Quran to positive humanist quotes. And it's really an attempt to reach out to people who might have humanist beliefs and they never realized before. You know, a lot of the really strong morals in this country are related to humanism. Kind of wanted to differentiate these positive humanist moral values from biblical literalists that kind of take religion to the extreme, as opposed to focusing on just values that anyone can have and should have regardless of religion.
Right. And what is it, like 16% of people who actually identify as being non-religious?
It's quite a high number. A lot of people are shocked by that. So we thought our campaign could really reach out to those and hopefully, you know, to even more. We really hoped religious moderates would appreciate this campaign as well, because we think a lot of religious moderates hold the same views as humanists do.
And so what were the various ways that we tried to reach those people? Talk about the campaign. Like, it was media, it was news, it was radio.
Yeah, we had two billboards. We had bus tails in Chicago and Los Angeles and San Francisco. And of course, we had ads all over the DC metro system, inside the metro cars, inside the buses. We were very excited about our first commercial, which aired on Dateline. And it was aired nationally and got a lot of really good feedback from viewers that were happily surprised to find a humanist commercial on NBC, which has never been done before.
Right. That's great. So actually, I have the audio from that ad. So let's go ahead and play that now. So listeners, just keep in mind that this ad is going to show you two different perspectives. The first is what some believe.
A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man. She must be silent.
And what humanists think.
The rights of men and women should be equal and sacred. Marriage should be a perfect partnership.
Great. So Sarah, where can listeners go to learn more about these ads and the quotes and their sources and things like that?
You can go to www.considerhumanism.org, and we have all the ads up there. If you'd like to print them out and show them to people, or if you just want to check out all the commercials that we produce, it's all on the website.
What has happened as a result of this campaign?
We've actually gotten a lot of really interesting feedback. We're covered in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, USA Today, Raleigh News and Observer. And I mean, everyone's take on the campaign differed slightly, but in general, we didn't get a lot of negative feedback, which we were pretty happy with. We even appeared on the O'Reilly Factor, the commercial that was just aired. Bill O'Reilly spoke briefly about it, which was really kind of a thrill to see.
Yeah. How'd that go? What did he have to say?
He was actually pretty positive. I would say he didn't have anything really negative to say. He essentially said, you know, they can think what they want, and I don't really think they're immoral, whatever. Next question. He kind of brushed over us. It was better than a full-on attack, I think. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that will come as Christmas is just around the corner, right?
Yes. Yeah. We're just waiting. That'll be interesting.
Yep. Well, this is great. I can see that considerhumanism.org, the website that you mentioned where people can view ads, they can discuss them, they can even actually bring the campaign to their town. I've seen that's gotten like over 3,000 likes on Facebook, so that's pretty cool. All right. So, Sarah, just wrapping it up, what can our listeners do to help expand this campaign?
Well, on the Consider Humanism website, we have a link that allows people who are interested to donate. And with that donation, we can bring our campaign to a bus line near you, a billboard, or a newspaper, whatever you'd really like. So if you think that this campaign will be beneficial to your city or town, just let us know and we'll try and work something out.
That sounds great. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for being here on the Humanist Hour.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
To learn more about Consider Humanism, To donate to the campaign or to bring the campaign to your town, visit the website considerhumanism.org. Well, folks, that about wraps up my show for this month. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, you can always read about and download previous episodes at our podcast page, humanistpodcast.org. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.